Mrs. Elmer Witt leading a discussion on all you wanted to know about Holden, didn't have time to ask. And I think it's a Monday like September 7th, if I recall. Glad to have you here. What I'll do, most of the time will just be spent in any questions that you have. I thought I'd start off by just telling you a little bit about the setup, the way Holden works. Who does what in terms of setting up the whole operation, not housekeeping and the kitchen, but that keeps the whole operation going. I used to spend a lot of time telling about its history, but I don't have to do that anymore because this book came out about 3 months ago by Chuck Lutz, and all the things that I would say about history are all right up here in the front pages, and you can read that in a much more careful way than I could tell you about it. Anyway, we have one of the specialists for the early years here anyway. I don't want to take any chances of saying things about those years because he remembers those better than I. As you would read in here, the village, the author heard a story about Wes Preeb writing and getting the gift to the village. So for right from the beginning, that's why it's called Surprising Gift, because it really was that it should work that way. Or as Carol Hinderly said too, that God should give it to these unimaginative Lutherans, So why would we know what to do with it? Well, it turned out that God helped us in that too. That the group of lay people, at least is the way I always tell it, got together, I think at Gil's house, and started figuring out what could be done to get this place moving and going. You want to close that so I don't disturb them? It was given, because it had to be given to a tax-free, tax-sheltered, what do they call it, tax? To LBI, it had to be given to an agency that could give it a tax credit to the House Island Mining Company. As you may know, or you may have read, if you have work in the National Forest, and when you're done with what you're doing there, if you're going to leave it there, you can't do that. You have to return the forest to its original condition. So if House Island Mining Company wanted to put all this back somewhere or whatever else, it would have been obviously an astounding piece of money that they would have had to come up with in order to do that. Well, so when they gave it away, they were saving money. There's no question. It was a great gift, but they obviously were saving money because they would have had to return the forest to its condition. But instead they gave the village, what they gave to us is what they owned. What they didn't own, they couldn't give to us, of course. And what they owned was the mountain and buildings around it that are a part of the mining operation, and a little piece of land that sticks out almost like on a triangle across Railroad Creek over to around where the path is that you go out when you go out towards the ballpark or up to Heart Lake. That's what they gave us there. And then they gave us all of the buildings in here, but none of this land. This land belongs to the National Forest. What Holden owns is the mountain and half of the rights to the minerals in the mountain. The other half was retained by LBI in Seattle. And then the buildings that are here. And we are here under what is called a special use permit of the National Forest Service, the Forest Service and Department of Agriculture. And there are many, many such special use permits. Nothing unusual. In fact, there are so many of them that they have stacks of regulations about what you have to do and not to do. Our permit itself, I might guess, is about, the major permit is about that thick, that tells you all the things that you can do and can't do. Because every time, and then we have a permit for various things. There's a permit for being here, as what we're called is an association camp. That is their way of handling the church business. They can't say church camp because that gets that church state going, but you can have an association camp. It can be various things, including churches as well. And then whenever we touch the Forest Service land again, if we put wires over the Forest Service land or put a sewer through, or if we put water through, or whatever it may be, then we also have to have permits for that. And when we put a tunnel under the Railroad Creek here about a year ago as an alternate plan for our sewer service, that was all permitted from county, state, Forest Service, and two state people. So we had four permits just to put that one in. So it's a complicated business about how to keep all of that going. That's how we are here. The LBI gave the village then to this entity that was put together with Gil's help at that time, and it is truly then owned by the board of Holden Village. that evolved. In fact, I don't remember, Bill Gill, how many were on the board originally?
Well, I don't remember exactly, but I think about 15.
My recollection was 15 also. I was on that board early in the time, glad to be. And then the board was expanded when it became more representational. This is some years after I was offered too. In order to get representatives from the Lutheran church bodies, they expanded the board so that if one small group had one or two members, you wouldn't have to have, you know, proportionately, somebody who would have 40 members or something like that, but they expanded so you could have representation. And the representation presently on the board is from the ALC, the LCA, and the AELC, the groups that are going to become one church in January, as well as the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And then we also have one person from the Lutheran Church of Canada, and we have two persons from the Methodist Church that are on the board as well. And they are picked by the board itself. It's a self-perpetuating board. And that board meets once a year up here at the village for 3 or 4 days. Last year they met in late June, early July. Next year they're going to be meeting in August. And then there also is a group from within that board. They select 9 people that become the trustees of the village, the Holy Village trustees. The board is responsible for the direction of the village, for any legal matters that are kept, that they make decisions if things important things were happening. For instance, there are people who are interested in helping reclaim the tailings out here. If that ever happened, that would be a serious impact on the village. The director of the village, obviously, and certainly not even the trustees, would have a right to say, okay, let's go ahead with that. The board itself, the Holand board, would make a decision like that. And it would be the trustees then who supervise all of the daily kinds of things. They are responsible for supervision of the administration and of the finances of the village, and then any legal contracts that are made, the signing of the permits with the Forest Service. That's done by the trustees. The chairman of the trustees does that. So they are responsible for daily operations and supervising all of the financial and legal matters. And then anything else that's happening, they turn over to the administration. Another thing that the board does is to set the criteria for the director. They establish what they're looking for in a director. And then there's a search committee assigned and all of that that goes that way. But they have a very strong role in the selection of the director. And then they also discuss and give approval, not by voting the wording, but of the emphases that go on in the village. Like when we're talking about the 25th anniversary this year with Christ as a memory of our future, they okayed that and down the line. So the board itself keeps a close connection with the program of the village. They have a feeling for the volunteers, what's happening among the volunteers, and what's happening with the numbers that are coming here, and what's going well, what isn't. And the trustees are much more than focused, as I said before, on the legal aspects and financial aspects, and then the more direct supervision. They meet twice a year, but can meet by phone anytime. There's only 9 members on that group. The members are representative of the church bodies by a very strange arrangement. I just tried to explain this in a letter to the Lutheran Church in Canada, and I told them at the end, I said, this may not sound very reasonable, but that's because it isn't, you know. It's not really reasonable. The board selects people. For instance, we have regional members. That means they are members of the Lutheran Church within the district or synod in which Holden lies. So at present time, it would be the ALC district or the LCA district or the West Coast Synod of the AELC. The board selects those people. They write in and apply and send in all the stuff, and the board selects them. After they selected them, they write to the bishop or the president of that district or synod and say, would it be okay with you if this person represented your church body on our here? Now, normally, churches don't operate that way. You know, they want to pick their own representatives. But they say, yeah, that's okay. And that's been true all the way through from Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and ALC and AELC and LC as well. And we trust that it will be in the future too. We may have to do some shifting around because of the region, because now we're in a much smaller synod the Eastern Washington and Idaho Synod of the ELCA. So whether we do some shifting about that, the board will be talking about that next year. Other than that, we have no direct connections to the church bodies. We go to conventions around here and try to let people know about it, but we don't make any reports to them. And of course, what they like most is we don't ask them for money. We gather our own funds from people who have been to Holden, our own constituency. We don't go out and get funds from other people. There are congregations who make contributions, of course, and we're really glad about that. And it's usually, in fact, as far as I know, it's always, it's because somebody in that congregation said, that's a good ministry, we ought to put some of our mission funds into that kind of ministry. But we don't approach the church bodies, and they have not, they have early on, they helped the church, Holden very much. But my guess again is about 1967, when we stopped getting funds from the church body. Is that about right? That's the way it operates. And then anything else that happens at the village is the responsibility of the director. He finds the people that are going to work, or she finds the people that are going to work here and the staff the positions and tries to keep it running and makes reports to the board and meets with the trustees regularly and has to be answerable for all that goes on. So that's sort of the structure. It's a fairly loose structure. They spend all their time finding a director and then trust like mad that the director will do a good job and keep an eye on them as well, which is good. Well, that's some background about it. I've got a copy of the Statement of Purpose in our Constitution, Articles of Incorporation, which I'll give you distribute these. It's one of the only in the church, and Chuck mentioned that in his book, that the church that has in its Articles of Incorporation humor. Because one of our goals is to keep people laughing at Holden, and that's one of the things you'll find in there, too. But you can talk about anything you want. And you can ask any question you want. I'll give you an answer. It may not be a good one, or it may not even be true, but I'll just give you an answer, too. It's about program, about buildings, about finances, about board, about anything. By the way, and anybody can apply to be on the board. Next year, we'll be replacing. There are 10 people each year, every third. You're on for a period of time of 6, so every fifth year you would be up again. So there'll be people being renewed in this next time around. And all you do is send a letter indicating your interest to Holden here or to the chairman of the board. You can get the name there. Then you get some forms to fill out and you can be part of the process. I think there were something like 120 people, I think, applied last time for the 10 positions that we filled. So a lot of people, and they're checked out. I served on that committee last time, and believe me, they check them very thoroughly. Well, so any questions you have?
Where does the water come from for the power station?
It comes from Copper Creek, which is in this valley. The valley up above us here is Copper Creek Valley, or Copper Creek Basin. And we have a diversion dam up quite a ways, not too far. They put the wilderness above us up here. It used to be way up on the peaks behind us, and 2 years ago, or was it 3, they dropped it down, and now it's just a few hundred feet above where we have our diversion dam to get the water that is used both for the hydro and used for the storage tank that we use in the village.
Was there a pipe there before, or did you put that in when you...
Was the water pipe from that dam already? It was for Howe Sound, wasn't it?
Well, from the lower dam, yes.
Yeah, the lower dam.
It was moved up, 200
right.
feet later on.
Mm-hmm. They had, for power, they had lines coming up from Chelan, public utilities, gave them their power. So they didn't, we put in the hydro.
Yes.
Right, that was ours. And that's, I think, when we put that up the dam, right?
How many guests can you accommodate at one time?
It varies a little bit because of the configuration of the families that use the rooms. You know, if it's a four-bedroom and only 3 people in it, we lose one person. Or if there's a cot or a crib in it, it goes in. So it ranges from 380 to about 420. That's comfortable. We can do it that way. Because we have cancellations, we have to overbook some. And if people don't cooperate and cancel, that obviously means we have more people than maybe we expected. But once this last year, for 2 nights, we had 30 more people than we have beds for. Tom Studelberg, our registrar, is such a great registrar. I mean, he's, by the way, our first male registrar. I think that's true. The first male registrar Or did Werner play that role too?
I haven't heard of any
okay.
Others.
He, we had just had Rainbow on a Mountaintop, which was our experience with the Blackfoots. We had some 62 black people who were with us for a good part of those 2 weeks. And we had a big poster and certain colors and everything else. So when he came to the community meeting of all of our staff, prior to this happening with the 30 Too Many, he had a sign in the same kind of lettering as Rainbow on the Mountaintop with all the colors and everything, and he labeled it Eviction on a Mountaintop. And then he told them the problem and had a list of 30 lines and asked who would sign up to move out of their rooms and move in with somebody else for the 2 nights, and he had it filled in 2 minutes. And they all then they shifted their things over and took their sleeping bags and slept with somebody else. Some of them slept outside, but for that short a period of time it worked. So finding out just when, how much to overbook, because what cancellations you're going to have is very tough. It was changed seriously this year because this is the first year we were had been, you know, October 1st for a deadline for the first reservations to be made. We shifted that to January 1st because we were getting up to 22% cancellations. We figured people making up their mind in September of the previous year had a lot of time to change their mind before July of the next year. So we set it on January 1st, and that reduced the amount of cancellation quite seriously, as we hoped it would. So that's why January 1st is the beginning of our registrations now. So, long answer to your question.
When one comes on their own, not in a group,
yes.
What are the costs? What are the charges?
It's been so long since I looked at it. $155 for a week, is that right?
I paid $120.
Well, right now it's lower. It's lower in September for...
Seniors discount.
It's discount. $150, there you are. For a week. $120 for seniors, right.
Number of people seem to come like for a weekend or a day at your...
Some do. Our average stay during the summer is a week. It's all, you know, it's 6.8 days or something like that. Now what we're trying to do is build up more of the winter community because we're pretty filled most of the summer, early June and sometimes late August, although this year late August was pretty full. And of course sometime in September we have room. But then in the weekends and for small groups, we can't take too many in the winter only because of the hydro. We don't have enough electric power. If we could get that in better shape, we could have some more up during the winter. We specialize then, as you've heard, on retreats and special weekends. We are ready. We limit to, I think, 24, a group of 24 coming up on those weekends because with the snow, we have two snow tracks. They take 12 each. So 24 is enough to come up without making a double run and not too hard on our hydropower. But I think we are already booked over for the weekend where we have adult children of alcoholics. It just came like this. And the single parents weekend is very popular too. So we'll be adding to the number of people coming by offering these 8 weekends in during the winter.
How far through the winter do you go?
All the way.
All the way?
Oh yes. Our winter program includes 2 10-week work study programs. One starts around October 1st, 5th, somewhere in there, and goes 10 weeks into December. And then of course some of those people leave. We limit that to 15 people. Sometimes it's 6, sometimes it's 12. Last year, I think it was 9 and 12, the 2 weeks. And the other one starts in February for 10 weeks. Then in addition, folks come up, some folks come up for Thanksgiving, a lot of folks come up for Christmas and the week after Christmas. And then also we have in January an interim group from alternating 1 year, Pacific Lutheran University, next year St. Olaf, comes up with 24 students for a month, and they do their interim up here. So we're going all of that time. The people of long-term staff live here year-round.
How do you keep your road open?
We use a plow when we can. This last year, a year before, we got 30 inches one night, and that made it a little difficult. When we can't use it, if it's too much too fast, then we just drive on top of it with the snow tracks. We're experimenting. Now, we just, I don't know if it's arrived yet, we have purchased a small rotary plow. We'd like to see whether that can be done and keep it down pretty much to the road and then be able to use our regular vehicles with chains on them. And that's, we're seeing if that will work. Anybody else?
Elmer. Do you agree with Carol Henderly when he said we're the most unimaginative people?
I don't think he even agreed with it.
Was he kidding?
Oh, I think he was kidding.
Oh, I think he was serious.
No, I don't. Well, he may have been serious, but he was wrong then. Because he himself is an imaginative person. I think he is. No, I think God knew what he or she was doing in giving us this place. Sure. No, I think we got marvelous imaginative people. And just being here any week, you can find that out. I'm sure. Yes?
Relying on volunteers, I guess. Do you always have enough people to staff?
It varies. Right now, we certainly do. We did during most of the summer. I think there were only 2 weeks in August where it was a little shaky. But even then, what we've done, as you've heard, you know, we're counting on more people to help out from the group, which makes it work very well. And for the winter, we often have more people asking than we can take. But we need names of volunteers usually for April and May when we start opening up things, and then especially early June and then late August. Those are the key points where we need people. So we encourage everybody to write in and come. The big changes in the last 5 years has been many more older people, once again, volunteering, along with a lot of young people.
On the right as you start up, are there privately owned places?
No, the A-frame is ours. We call it the Holden Hilton. In case during the winter we would have an avalanche, as we often do, usually every year at least one or two, and anybody would get stuck. We would be so large that we couldn't get over it. Somebody would be stuck down there. There's a place to be. And also there's sometimes when the boat has some trouble. If you're down there and just sitting in a bus or something, it gets pretty cold. So that's also our waiting place for them. And it was built with, of course, Forest Service approval. And I think that's a sign of where bureaucracy went bananas. You take a look at the foundations for that when you're down there. When the end of the world is coming, God's going to have to come back and take that building somehow, because that building won't go anyplace. It's terribly overbuilt. It was all in good shape until it got to the upper levels of the Forest Service, and somebody said, oh boy, they might have earthquakes down there. We got concrete coming out of our ears down there. But that's what it's for. And we have medical supplies and other kinds of foodstuffs and things like that, and of course there's wood around so that somebody could be taken care of down there if they got isolated. Yes?
Is there any special story associated with the Hobbit House?
Well, I suppose there are lots. It's really closely associated, with the whole Hobbit theme, which I think the interest in that grew out of the Narnia emphasis at the village, and the Narnia, the C.S. Lewis stories. They often had, during Carol Hinderly's time here, just specialists in C.S. Lewis come and telling stories, reading stories, and doing that. And I think the interest then evolved so that the Hobbit House just sort of grew out of that. Obviously, it was probably just one summer or one winter somebody got the idea and did it, and it sticks. It'd be amazing how many of our long-term rituals started only about 2 years ago or whatever it is. We're very willing to make something a ritual. Somebody else? Yes?
People who belong to a denomination other than Lutheran come here?
Oh, yes. Many.
Anybody?
Many, many. Right. People who are not Christian come here. We have Jewish people here. We have them on staff as well as who come as guests. I've been trying to get a rabbi to be on our teaching staff, and so far I haven't been successful just because of scheduling. Yeah, very. First of all, we would want it that way because, again, that's one of the ways that we learn from one another. And secondly, we couldn't do anything about it because we're on National Forest land. We can't keep anybody away. We wouldn't want to. Sure. I think there'll be a few more other than Lutheran members on the board eventually, too. Now it's a good number of women on the board. I think of the last 10, I think there were 7 women elected to the board, and there were 4 or 5 on the board already. So it's probably 12 or 14 women, and now there'll probably be some consideration of some other representation.
You mentioned 2 Methodists on the board. Mm-hmm. Are they from this part of the country, or?
Yes, one is... One's from Seattle, and I think the other one is from BC, British Columbia. I'm not sure at the moment. Can't remember.
How long have you had the grand in the chapel, that
large
concert grand.
Oh, dear, I don't remember. That came during Carol's time, didn't it, to Gil? The piano?
I don't know when that came.
That was one of those times when they gathered funds one evening because they thought they needed something better than a piano. And they got an amazing amount, and within a short time they had enough. And there was a fellow in the village, apparently, who sold pianos. And he gave them a good price on it, and there we had it. And all of our guests who come as artists and musicians here are just so delighted because they expect it to be some clunker, and it's a fine piano.
Very fine.
Yeah, we're grateful.
Remember how much it cost?
No, don't. It came from Texas, my recollection, or at least the fellow was from Texas. And you know, all the shipping and everything else to get it up here, besides. Okay. Yes.
What's your average winter time temperature?
I don't know. That we have those figures. I can ask the people who keep those. Right. We've been keeping some records like that for the weather service for 25 years. We had a meeting here early in summer, and a fella stood up in the next room, and I didn't know who he was. And he says, "Well, while you're having this discussion, can I make a presentation?" I said, "Oh, sure." He says, "Well, I'm from the Weather Bureau, and this day." Today, when he was here, was the 25th anniversary since Holden had been keeping Weather Bureau records for them as volunteers. And so he gave us a plaque that's hanging up there for all those years. I don't know what it is. I think it's delightful. I think, you know, most of the time runs around between 32 and 28, which I think that I couldn't. I lived in Chicago for the last 30 years before I came here. I couldn't go out to my garage in the clothes that I wear here in the middle of winter. I'd be frozen stiff in Chicago, but it's totally different. It can get cold. It's been down to 10 above and things like that, but that's rare. Doesn't happen every winter up here. We have lots of snow. You know, the nice thing is you don't have to shovel it. You don't have to drive in it. You just walk on it. That's lots easier.
When does the snow start, as a rule?
As soon as it's ready. It can be 2 years ago was October 12, last year was in November, early November. It varies. Certainly, we'll see it up in the mountains in October for sure.
We've had snow in the village since September.
Oh, yeah. There's recorded snow in Holden every month of the year, they tell me. That if you go back to the Howe Sound mining days, that they have recorded some snow in the village every month of the year. So it's possible for it to happen. Yeah, but I remember the first summer for the Stehekin we had up here, when we had a Vespers out at the ballpark. I'll bet I had four or five jackets and sweaters on, and we were freezing like mad, and that was in August. It was really cold that day. I know the next summer we came up, we brought all the clothes we along with us, and of course it was in the 70s and 80s the whole time. But it can get cold during the summer here.
How do you maintain the food supply during the winter, especially?
Well, the... We stock up in advance, of course, with the barge. There's a barge that comes up once a week during the summer. That stops about October 15th. And then the rest of it is good, careful ordering in advance that's brought up on the boat. The boat comes up at least three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And they may be coming up on a Sunday this year, too. Well, there are certain times of year it's Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then it goes to just Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then back to Sunday again, but I think it may just go all season long. He's the owner of the boat company, a new owner now for about 2 years, is really trying to beef up the use of the boat. So he'll be probably doing 4 days a week.
The lake doesn't freeze then?
No, it's 1,900 feet deep at its deepest part. No way. It doesn't freeze.
What's the altitude here?
3201.
Now what's the average depth of the snowpack around here?
I always get this figured. I can't remember. Is it 350 or 250? I think it's 350, because we were below that this last year. Now, that's the snowfall.
No, I mean the pack.
Well, I guess I suppose it depends on when you're talking about, too. The average is probably 5 feet.
So do you have to tunnel down into your entrances and that sort of
thing? Into this entrance we do, but the rest are okay. When I walk into my chalet over there, I have 7 or 8 steps going up, and I just go from the last step up to my porch. I just walk right across. where you have the water fountain on the fence out there, you just walk right across that. It's way underneath you. It's tricky in the summer. I mean, it's tricky in the spring when it starts getting loose underneath. That's when it's tricky. Yeah.
Is there any homing pigeons in the loft?
No, no.
Been discontinued?
No, the martins discontinued it.
Oh,
yes. On two occasions. They had a feast. Yeah. So they gave up. This is some years ago, but they gave up. They call it the telecommunications center up there. Yes?
Elmer, was the Lady of the Lake built in Chelan?
This lady was, yes. Took them a good number of years. I don't know, 5 or 6, if I recall. There have been a couple of groups that own the Lake Chelan Boat Company. And Mr. Raines, Jack Raines, who's now the principal owner, I think he may be the sole owner, was one of a group of four, I think. And it was not going well. And he then was able to force the others to sell out to him, and he became the manager of it. And I think excuse the pun, he's running a tight ship to get that done. Yes?
I don't hear any telephones jingling around here. I was wondering what sort of communications you maintain with the outside world, and especially for emergency communications with someone else.
We have three radio systems. One with the sheriff's office via Stehekin. When the radio goes down the valley and gets bounced up to Stehekin. The second one is with the Forest Service down in Chelan. That's not too good on weekends, and certainly not late at night. And the third one, which we put in only a little over a year ago, is with the Chelan Police Department. And there we bounce it down the valley, down the lake, and we pick up it on a repeater right above, it's called Slide Ridge, right above 25 Mile Creek. And that transfers it directly into 911 in Chelan. When they gave me notice of my daughter's accident 3 weeks ago, it was Chelan 911 that radioed up to tell me. So there's a good connection. We got the three because you don't want to take any chances. One might not be working, and the atmosphere affects it in the winter and all of that, so we try to be very careful.
Are all three of them 24-hour service, or is it only the police?
Well, the sheriff and the police would be. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that was a great concern of mine when I came here. I wanted some better contact because of emergencies. And we've had a number of those. Nothing, you know, drastic, but it was great to be able to have things ready and be able to get people to help. Someone else? Yes?
Tell us about the cross in the chapel.
Yes, I'm sorry that the sheet of paper, there were two sheets of paper up earlier in the summer, and they disappeared, and I can't find the original. It's happened 2 years ago. That we were looking for a symbol, and Dan Erlander, which some of you may know, he's one of our favorite teachers here at Holden Village. He's a campus pastor now at Pacific Lutheran University. Got the idea because he had traveled in Central America and in Mexico to have a cross put together that would represent some of the church's life and art down there. So through a friend of his, we were able to get some El Salvadoran refugees who were living in Mexico City to paint the squares. If I recall, there's 18 or 19 of those squares. And they were then mailed up to us in a little box. And then one of our workers, Henry Herfindahl, built the cross, and then we set those squares in there. And we've sent them pictures of them. We try to stay in touch with those people down there. First of all, we think it's an object of beauty and, of course, a helpful thing for worship. And it does reflect their kind of art that they would use in church in their own country. And it also is a connection with them as people who are under oppression at the present time, and so we like that connection too. We'll still try to find that sheet and put it up. It's something they wrote about the cross.
Okay. What are most of the pictures of? I haven't looked at it that carefully.
Animals, a lot of animals, a lot of agricultural scenes, reflection, birds, and a lot of the sun is very important. In those pictures, some buildings. Mm-hmm. You're surely invited to go on up and take a look. I think it's a lovely piece that they did. Someone else? Yes?
How many hours a day does the Narnia program in the summer meet for children? And is it a set program?
No, would you repeat your first question again?
Okay, how many hours a day is
the Narnia program
for children?
Narnia is runs Monday through Friday from 8:45 to 11:45. And it's not a set program because it just hasn't evolved that way. The quality of the things that happen, we have good care for the children. There's never any question in my mind about that. The quality of the programming depends lots on the people who help put it together, and that means the volunteers that we can find. This year, we had one of our best. David, Pardon?
Van Gilder?
Was it?
The Kite Man?
Oh, no. No, that's Art and Vi. No, he just used the building. But David was here for that. He was a good educator, and the program went very well. And we're looking for people right now who will be able to come. We'd like to get somebody to come for longer than a few weeks. Often our volunteers want to come only for 3 weeks. Well, with Narnia, we'd like to have somebody who did the whole summer for us. And we're once again working on that.
What are the age of the children?
From 0 to 12. That's the way we say it. So it's babes in arms. We've had them up here 4 and 5 weeks old. But they're accepted, and then... they have different age groupings, the beavers in different groups, and do different things different days. We try to have a good emphasis on some stories related to the Christian faith, and especially an emphasis on the creation that is around us. They go up to the mine, they do some pot shop work, they'll take a nature hike or whatever it may be. We have emphases on that. Lots of people here, more children though, maybe in the last 3 years than for some time. We had as high as 80, 90 children in Narnia, some weeks. It's a lot. Somebody else?
How many people are in school here now? Are there people?
Yes, I think our elementary school has, I think, 11 children. That's in grades 1 to 6, and I think there are 2 grades she doesn't have. So she's covering a number of grades. And then I think it's 5 in high school. That's paid for by the Lake Chelan School District. That they hire the teachers, although we interview them up here as well, and they pay the salaries, they pay for all the materials and all the things that are done here, and they pay us rent for the use of the building that the school is in during this school year.
Are the high school people brought back down below for science or lab classes and like that?
Just do whatever can be done here. They get skimped a little bit in sciences, no question about that, but the superintendent is very careful to find a science-oriented teacher. If you're applying for that job and you've got good science background, you've got a better chance than others, because he wants to keep that focus simply because of the isolation. So I think that the education that children get here is just superb. It might not meet all the standards that some people put together, but I think, I'm not convinced that sending kids off to be alone in a school is the best way to educate them anyway. But the interaction with the adult world in which they live, and the many people who serve as surrogate teachers and the rest of it, I think, are just marvelous. If one of our teachers says, we really are studying some stuff in French, and some of the children want to learn some French, we usually have somebody in the school, in the village, who will teach them French. And all of a sudden, they've got a French class going, and then at meals one day, you'll have a French table, and they'll all sit around and talk that way. And then somebody will be coming back, just came from India, and come up and spend maybe 2 hours with them, showing them slides and answering questions. There's a lot of people from around the world that come here. So it's a really good, and then of course, although it covers a number of grades, you know, the ratio isn't that bad. There's a teacher and an aide for the 11 children, and one teacher for the high school 5. So it's pretty good. I'm impressed with just watching the children come and seeing how they are and seeing the change in them a year or 2 years later. Just amazing. I'm really pleased with that. Somebody else? Yes?
I think you answered this before, but I wasn't sure.
Okay.
What is the elevation here?
3201, I believe that's the right figure. Right next to the entrance to the pool hall, down in the cement step, you'll see the the figure put in, I mean the metal plate put in there with the elevation on it at that spot.
32.06.
Six. See, I was 5 feet off. But it's at that spot, wherever you go in the village, it obviously varies. Somebody else?
Higher.
Yes.
I shouldn't ask it, probably. Do you ever have any trouble going up and down the road?
No.
No?
Mm-hmm. You mean like trouble like...
Oh, truck stopping or wouldn't go or...
Oh, yes. Indeed. Terrible. Yes. Oh, yeah, and our snow tracks every once in a while. For a while, they were taking them down the switchbacks, which I did not think was a good idea. We finally put a stop to that. They're just not made for switchbacks. And we'd have a track off or something down there, you know, with 12 people in it, and they'd have to get out, and then we'd have to find another way and send somebody down to get those tracks back on. It can be a lot. But we have, of course, a year-round mechanic here, and usually a backup person for him as well. So they're usually in very good shape, and we have higher standards than the state would have, of course, even for the condition of our vehicles. We try to watch that very, very carefully. So there's a lot of screaming, you know, and you can't go to an auto parts shop down the block either. You got to make it work. And the snow tracks especially are difficult. They're expensive, and they show the wear and tear. They weren't... These are obviously second-hand ones. They aren't the latest that are there, so there's a lot of repair on those during the winter.
I noticed that Stehekin, they had a number of different vehicles. Mm-hmm. Do you have many? I know the Forest Service would have vehicles here, but are there many here in this area?
Private vehicles,
yeah.
No, we have none.
Oh, okay.
But we have, we must have 26 or more vehicles that the village owns, which are... plows and graders, and as well as the buses and garbage hauling and trucks for luggage and all of that. We have a good number of vehicles.
What do you do with the garbage?
We're just working on a solid waste plan by which it can be, we try to return a compostable stuff back to use in our garden, which is not a large garden, but at least it is a garden. And then the rest of the solid waste we try to get rid of getting it planted into the tailings at certain places. That's being worked out once again with the Department of Ecology. They weren't as pleased with what was happening, and they have some new regulations. And I think on, it's next week, Wednesday and Thursday, some engineers, consulting engineers on solid waste handling will be here in the village for 2 days. And we're working on a revised program of how we do that. We're trying not to put a lot of it in the tailings, because the tailings are some things we'd like to have dealt with anyway. If we put more stuff in it, it's going to make it more difficult to deal with the tailings. Don't know if that's even possible. Yes.
That's ties into a question. I was wondering, you mentioned the tailings before.
Sure.
Are they considered part of the environment, or would you like to see them out of here?
Oh, we'd like to see them out of here. They're listed by the EPA nationally and certainly in the state as first or second most toxic and undesirable thing to be here. Now, it doesn't bother anybody because it's not affecting the water or anything, because we go above that. The wind blows the stuff around, and it's just it's an unsightly kind of a piece too. So we would like for something to be done with that. Obviously,
they're not part of the historical district or
no,
at all.
No,
you
no.
Like to see the
Forest Service, Department of Ecology, Department of Health would all applaud any moment that... in fact, very likely the Forest Service will be investing some money, well, has already, in finding out how this is put together and what's in there that could be taken out of it. They have studies on that, and they just talked to us about, I think, a $30,000 fund that they may have for the continuation of study of what can be done with these. They're getting pressure from the state and even from the federal government about that, so it's not a desirable thing.
In other words, the village has no part of that. That's not a village responsibility.
Well, it's on Forest Service land, and it was put there by the House Sound Mining Company, but the village owns the above ground and below ground claims that are on there. We've staked claims on much of this area in order to protect it from being somebody coming in, staking a claim, and starting operation of some kind of work. So I doubt that we could escape clearly. In fact, there was a law passed this year, I was told, in which now the federal government holds not only the original owners and secondary owners, but the present owners of toxic or undesirable things, also responsible. So if we got to that, what most of the people who are involved in are just involved in how can we get rid of it. They're not trying to find out who's doing what or who's going to be responsible. We have very good cooperation from the Forest Service and the state in trying to find ways to get rid of it.
Elmer?
Yep.
I understand there's pretty large cavities in the hill over there. Is there any chance to be dumped back where it came from?
Yes, but again, the money to do all that is what the biggest problem is. They estimate that it would take really millions of dollars to do all that work. And that's what the key has been. What they're trying to find out is how much useful metal are in the tailings, so that it might be profitable to reprocess. So that a company would come up and if that process was followed, they would get gain out of it from the metals, and then the Forest Service and Holden would have the requirements of making it reforestable. That seems to be the approach presently, but because everything else is horrendously expensive with no income.
Could you give us a shot on your annual budget? I don't want
about 600,000.
About
600,000. Mm-hmm. See, that's with volunteers. If you probably have to, triple that if you're paying people. I guess that's be what it would
looks
be.
Like you're doing a lot with that.
It's a healthy budget, and we're glad that we were able to meet it. It's as we've indicated, the capital expenditures are the things that have been the toughest part for us now in these last years. We had a lot of things to redo 2 years ago, and then of course this last year in October, and then till now has been very expensive for capital expenditures. Yes?
Do the volunteers render their services solely for board and room?
Yes, that's correct.
Does nobody
pay their own way? They pay their own way out here and back. If they stay longer than 4 months, and we provide boat tickets for them every 6 weeks to get out and do some visiting on the outside. And if they stay over a year, we are willing to pay them a stipend based on need, a minimum amount that takes care of when they do go out to pay for phone calls and for their car insurance or if they have a car down there, and toiletries and whatever else, and postage, things like that. That's if people are staying here a year or more. So basically it's room and board, which is not bad. And of course, the living in this place, which is not bad, and the program, which is not bad. We think all three of those are pretty good pay. And they seem to think so too. The amazing thing is that these people started with volunteers on the teaching staff. There are other places not just like this, but similar to Holden. And they've been paying their teaching staff for years, as well as other people. And I get some of their newsletters, and 1 week it might cost $150, the next week it might cost $350 because the people they have that week, they have to pay more. And it just jumps all over the place. I'm really delighted that we started with volunteers and we still get plenty of volunteers to come and teach. We're grateful for that. One of the very great ideas. One of the two unique things that I see about Holden Village, contrast to maybe three, is its setting, which is so marvelous. Secondly, its isolation. You really have to want to get here, right? And thirdly, is its volunteer service in all of the areas. There are only three salaried people in the village. So that makes it really unique.
Getting back to your transportation.
Sure.
Do you have any small snowmobiles, like for emergency runs and so on, that are used getting down your hill?
Oh, yes.
Do you do that?
Yes. We have two snowmobiles we use most of the time, and we have a backup one that we could use too. Yes.
Do you have any accidents going down the hills or the road?
We've had yes, we have. We had one in September of 65. I think. Five, right? I think. 85. We had a bus accident and someone was injured, and we're glad that he's being restored. Other than that, I don't know any accidents that have had. There have been problems, as you've said, about buses, vehicles getting stuck and all that kind of stuff. Are you aware of any others, Gil, accidents on the road?
Well, I could tell you about a truck that we lost once.
Oh, dear.
You don't know about that.
No, I don't know about that. See, that's why I come to these sessions.
I don't know. I should even talk about it.
I tend not to.
We had a pickup truck parked on the switchback for use in the wintertime, mm-hmm. because there wasn't that much snow there.
Mm-hmm.
And they parked it on the road there. I don't know. I don't know just how they parked it, but either somebody released the brakes or the braking boulders that we put under it, and the thing got loose and went over the hill. And it's still down there.
Yes.
If you want to look for it.
Dear me. No, I hadn't heard that story. Well, fortunately, though, that's all right when they go by themselves.
There's no one in it.
Yeah, no one in it. That's great.
Elmer?
Yes?
Can you tell this group how many miles of tunnel there is in the hill?
Oh, boy. It's in here, and I don't remember. It's a lot. 55? 55, is that right?
56 miles.
56 miles of tunnel in the mountain, right. If you get up to the more Portal Museum, and if that's too far for you to go, we can arrange to have some vehicles take some of you up, because it's worthwhile spending some time just looking at the pictures of how the mine was set up and how they worked in that mine. It's really interesting. By the way, later this month, I think you know this yet, Gil, we have 180 people who worked in the mine coming up on a Saturday, including a former vice president of the House Iron Mining Company, who now lives in Colorado. He's coming out for the day. It's their anniversary visit. This is their 30th anniversary of the closing of the mine. And Nigel Adams has worked out this group. I thought he'd bring 30, 50 or something like that. And we got a letter from him, and he has listed 180 names of people who are coming up here on the 26th of this month. So we're looking forward to having those our guests. And we're going to keep our tape recorders going, and we're trying to get a video recorder going too, and record some of the folks that are coming up. Come on out.
What type of scientific project do you have going on?
What
type of scientific project do you have?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, you used to have a lot.
Oh, the Science Advisory Committee?
No,
the
scientific projects that you're... Oh, you used to have it like all the fish.
And oh, yeah. I don't think we have any at the moment. We still are curious about what could be done about the tailings, but now we're doing that through outside resources and consultants rather than things here. Right. Because, the fish project didn't work, the pigeon project didn't work, and we were having trouble keeping the artichokes going as well. Of course, that was working because we were taking the effluent from the sewer, from the septic system up there, and that's no longer happening. That all goes now out to the miners' village for the drain field. So there's been a number of changes, but our work has been now mostly with working with folks who have been experimenting maybe elsewhere or learn about things elsewhere, and we see what we can learn from them as a village. Anyone else? You folks ask good questions.
Are you using the sawmill very much now?
When we have people who are really equipped to work with it, we do, yes. Because we're doing some interior redecorating yet and use a variety of things. And we hope to get into some, we have some good carpenters lined up, I think, for year round this winter. So we hope to get in some more projects too. We were having trouble getting loggers this year. We haven't brought in as many logs as we want or need, and we're working on that at the moment. There'll be a couple coming up yet this month, for sure.
Why is the wood supply so short this year?
Because we didn't have loggers.
Oh.
Right.
I thought you were burning oil or something.
No. We still use a lot of wood. It's the most dangerous thing in the village. It's the one where we have most, our wood stoves are the ones that cause us most scare with fire. We're also committed to trying not to use a lot of diesel oil, which costs us good money. And we pay for the wood too, but of course lots less. But we don't want to lose a building either. So we're trying to find the alternate ways constantly. We're always trying to find better ways of using the hydro system that we have. The engineers coming next week will be looking at that hydro system. The distribution system in the village for the hydro too. So it's going to be a part of our effort to improve the amount of power.
Do you have enough water coming down there to increase it considerably?
No. That's the problem. In we'll have by the end of the month we'll have brownouts and blackouts because of the water supply getting low. As soon as we get some freezes, you know, up above us, then the stuff doesn't keep coming as well. And in January and February, there can be a lot of them. It depends on a good number of things, and it certainly depends on what we all use here. We get to a point where we say no more hair dryers. You know what hair dryers are? You know what hair is? I was telling them, I don't care. I'm not using one anyway. So we close down buildings, of course, as much as possible, so that we can have 6-8 blackouts a day. It just goes out for 15 minutes or so while the fellow gets out there and resets it, and we go back at it again. Nobody gets hurt, so it's you get used to that part of it. But we'd like some more because, as I said before, that would save us some of that running around, but also enable some more people to come during the winter, which is a lovely time to be here.
Is there a higher...